Chris Voss, welcome to the Maz Hakim podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure's all mine, Chris. I want to start off by asking a little bit about your background and how you became an FBI hostage negotiator.
Yeah, well, an unremarkable background. Nothing special about me at all. Midwest, United States, grew up in a small town, a blue-collar family. My father was an entrepreneur. Then when I was in my mid-teens, I decided I want to be a police officer and became a police officer in Kansas City, Missouri, KCMO. Okay. Great, great Midwestern town. And then along the way, my father had more ambitions for me. So he convinced me to look at federal law enforcement. And actually, I was initially very interested in the Secret Service. He had a friend that was with the Secret Service and he introduced me to that guy. And and he told me that he traveled all over the world. Now, I'm originally from a small town in the Midwest. I'd never been anywhere. I mean, literally, I'd barely been out of the state.
Wow.
And he said, you know, I traveled all over the world for the Secret Service. And I thought, wow, you know, somebody paid you to travel all over the world? I'll take that job.
Yeah.
And as fate would have it, and I am a bit of a believer in fate, the Secret Service was not hiring, but the FBI was. I didn't know the difference. And so I put in for the FBI, and they hired me.
Wow.
And then I ended up in New York City, didn't really want to go to New York. Loved it. Loved it. And when, you know, I became a hostage negotiator and, you know, just kind of continued.
You mentioned you're a bit of a believer in fate.
Right, yes.
How does that play a part, I guess, in your life and as a negotiator? How does that play a part?
Yeah. I don't think things are predestined, but I do think that there's a basic path, you know, that the universe, God, whatever you believe in, wants us to follow. And we have a fair amount of latitude within that path. We can make mistakes. But if the path is really determined to send you in one direction or another, for example, when I was in New York, I did really well in New York and imagined that I would finish my entire career there. And then a senior manager came in that didn't like me at all and basically let me know that my career was not going to advance as long as he was around. And so the hostage negotiation unit wanted me to come down there and work for them full time a lot. And that was really sort of my plan B at the time. But I thought, well, I might as well leave and go there because my future here does not look good. And I went there and it was phenomenal. It was one of the best moves I ever made. And so I thought, all right, well, you know, the world, the fate, the universe had something else in mind for me to go in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes bad things happen to you that are meant to steer you in another direction. And whether you want to go or not, sometimes you got to go. And that's really what I chalk it up to.
Right. How did your experience as a hostage negotiator inspire you to write Never Split the Difference?
Well, it was, you know, I thought that hostage negotiation was really just about people smarts. And then when I first learned it on a crisis hotline in New York City, you know, people that are suicidal or in emotional crisis. And it amazed me how effective it was with people under pressure. And I thought, well, you know, if maybe this is good for everybody. So I started to apply it just in my normal life and in my interactions with my colleagues, and it made a big difference. And then I just strongly suspected that it's not just hostage negotiation, it's just people smarts.
Yeah.
And so then that continued. And when I left the FBI, I started teaching in business schools, Georgetown, the business school, Harvard, and just the people smarts of hostage negotiation. And the people that I taught it to made better deals and they had better relationships and they were happier. And that's really just what it's about. I mean, everybody at our base layer is just a human being, no matter where we grew up, no matter what our religion is, even regardless of our gender. You know, we're all wired pretty much the same as human beings. And as I found that, the luxury I had as a hostage negotiator, I got a chance to try it out all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, all over the world.
Wow.
And it was just people smart. So I thought, well, let's make this a business book or even a personal development book.
So people and called it, you in dangerous circumstances or situations, or were you there at the time, just by luck?
Well, and when I was in New York, it was if I was there when something happened. It was a bank robbery with hostages, and I went out. You know, it happened to be in New York, and I was close by, and we went, and it made a big difference. I got one of the bank robbers to surrender to me. And when I started working kidnappings, then any American that got kidnapped anywhere in the world, it was my job to come up with a strategy that got them out. So then I was sort of invited as an advisor globally, whether it was the Philippines or Africa or Iraq or anywhere. And what I found from that experience was it didn't make any difference. People are the same all over the world.
Was it a stressful job?
Stress is like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I once saw a bumper sticker that said, "What's the difference between adventure and ordeal? Attitude." So I thought the job was a privilege. And if you're doing something that you think is a privilege, you don't get burned out. You don't run out of energy. I mean, you get up every day looking for the opportunity to help somebody in their darkest hour. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I found it a privilege. Now, it after doing it all the time for 7 years, it did wear me out. But I didn't know it at the time. You know, I thought I was doing God's work, if you will.
Yeah. What do you think is the most important skill when it comes to negotiation?
Really listening, actually listening. There isn't any negotiation methodology that's taught anywhere that doesn't list listening as an advanced skill. My brothers and sisters at Harvard, at Wharton, at IMD in Switzerland, you know, at Tel Aviv University, everybody lists listening as an advanced skill. And listening is not just keeping your mouth shut. Listening is actually considering what people say, reflecting on it, looking for the patterns or the insights, which in that order is a higher level of thinking. Insight is a higher level of thinking, of reflection, of assessment. It was, I'm listening to a podcast in the U.S. I was on Lex Fridman's podcast not that long ago, and he was interviewing Sam Harris. And Sam said cognitive empathy, which is really close to tactical empathy. He called it a version of reasoning. Mm-hmm. To really think about what people say takes effort. So the biggest advantage is to actually listen without getting triggered. Mm-hmm. You know, your own prejudices get in the way of actually hearing what somebody has to say. Mm-hmm. So listening is really the hardest thing.
And I would love to hear some stories of high-stake negotiations. You mentioned an earlier one about a bank robbery. I'm not sure if some of these are confidential, but I'd love to hear some stories.
Yeah, well, I could talk about it. I was, on my visit here to Dubai, the places that I get to see, I'm staying at the Sheraton Grand, and I was talking to some of their people today. And, of course, you and I both like going to the Capital Club of Dubai.
Yes.
Phenomenal place for people to do business internationally. I'm very impressed with how international everyone that shows up there is. And like most of Dubai, really want to conduct business productively and profitably.
Yes.
With mutual gain. And that's what I love about the Capital Club, the type of people that come there. Mm-hmm. But earlier today I was talking about kidnapping in the Philippines, where it was a serial killer and it was a lone kidnapper. Now, a lone kidnapper is rare. And for example, I'd never even heard of a lone kidnapper because kidnapping is a business. And if it's a business, you got a bunch of people that are involved, and the commodity is human beings. Whether you like it or not, that's the reality of that business. And so if it's a commodity, people that acquire the commodity, transfer the commodity, house the commodity, negotiate for the commodity. Everybody has a different job. Mm-hmm. So it's rare that it's one person. And when we engaged in this kidnapping at the time, I thought we were talking to the leader, which is rare also. If you talk to a company, you rarely talk to the CEO. You talk to the CEO's representative. You almost never talk to the person actually in charge. And in this case, I sensed right away, I thought we were talking to the leader. I didn't realize that, you know, he was the boss. He was the lone operation. And I was coaching the brother. It was a Chinese kidnapping. Chinese are known sort of ethnically to keep to themselves. And in some cities, that makes them favorite targets for kidnapping. Manila happens to be one of those places. And I'm coaching the brother, and the brother was coachable. He was phenomenal. And if you could imagine, your brother's been kidnapped. You think the person is going to kill your brother, and there's an FBI agent whispering in your ear telling you what to say or telling you how to say it. I mean, that's stress.
Yeah.
And this guy that I coached was phenomenal. I asked him about it after the fact. I said, "You're one of the most coachable people I have ever met. You know, what was going through your mind?" And I think he was an unconscious samurai, because the samurai are famous for not being afraid of death because they thought about it. They just considered that death was a possibility. I could go into battle and I could get killed. I have to accept that it's a possibility. And consequently, they were far more effective. And this gentleman, his name was Aaron, told me, "I simply realized that it was possible that my brother could die and it would be out of my control." He says, "I have no idea if that's what you're talking about, but I just accepted it as a possibility early on." And, you know, it was really interesting for him to tell me that. So we got into the kidnapping. We don't really know for sure that this is a lone guy. And at the time, we also don't know that he's a serial killer. He was. And the Philippine National Police decided they wanted to do a rescue because they thought that they had this guy's phone isolated. He was talking to us on a cell phone. What he'd actually done was wire his cell phone to a house that was over a half a mile away. And he'd run a wire so far away that he didn't care that people tracked him because it wasn't there. So the Philippine National Police decided to do a rescue, and I was very leery of that. I remember going to bed that night thinking, I could wake up in the morning to a dead hostage. So we get up the next day. They'd done the rescue, and, you know, American phrase would be a dry hole. There was nobody there. They hit the wrong place. We completely expected the killer to call the next morning enraged, and we were trying to decide how we were going to handle it. And he calls on a phone and basically he's completely calm, so, you know, "Where's my money?" And we're thinking, this guy has no idea there was a rescue the night before. He has no idea. The Philippine National Police missed by so far that he didn't even know what happened. You know, he's talking to us on the phone as if nothing happened. So we continue the negotiations. We're bargaining hard. International kidnaps are about ransom. It's a commodities business. You got to pay for the commodity. And we're bargaining them down. And we'd got to the point where the family could afford to pay. I'm only an advisor. And my advice is, will they come? If you pay, will they come out? And at this point in time, we thought they would, but I thought I could get a better price. My negotiators are getting ready to come out. I'm sending two more in. The negotiators in country call me on the phone. They say, "You know, we could get him out now. We're pretty sure that if we paid, he'd release." And I said, "Nah, we can still get a better price." So they go, "All right," because they wanted to be there when the hostage came out. A day later, while our negotiators are in transit, the Philippine National Police come back and they say, "We've got another location." Now they're being assisted by several multi-letter agencies. You know, the FBI has all these, the FBI, the CIA, the DEA, you know, all these people with all these letters. Well, they're helping out, and now we've got pretty good intel as to where they think the hostage is being held. So they ask permission to do another rescue. The family gives a go-ahead. I'm not opposed. And they go out and hit the place, and the hostage is not there, but the kidnapper's wife is. It's another house that he owns. So they grab her and convince her to tell him about another house that her husband owns. And she, "Yeah, got another house. He goes there a lot of times. I never go there. I don't know what goes on." So they go to that house and they hit that place. And the kidnapper is not there, but the hostage is.
Wow.
He's in the basement. So they just set up inside the house and wait for our kidnapper to come home. And they grabbed him, rescued the hostage, and that's when we found out the whole story. He was a serial killer. Jeez. He was a serial kidnapper. He'd kidnapped a number of other people where ransoms had been paid and hostages had never been released. There was actually a kidnapping that he had committed that I knew about, I just didn't know it was him. Several years earlier, there'd been a kidnapping I'd been informed of in the Philippines where the kidnapper had carved the hostage's ear off and sent the ear and the video to the hostage's employer, which, of course, they paid right away as soon as they saw that. This actually came up in our case because the kidnapper threatened to do that in this case. And the Philippine National Police told the family, said, hey, this happened one other time here. As a matter of fact, we still have the video. And they brought the video and they showed it to the family of the previous case, which horrified them. And if I hadn't been there on the phone with them to stabilize them out, they would have given in at that point in time. Who knows what would have happened? But we lengthened it out about 21 more days. And then we made the rescue happen and we got them out.
Wow. Did his wife have any idea of what he was doing?
Or? Not to my knowledge. Most of the rest of the story, the Philippine National Police handled the follow-up. There was a trial. They interrogated everybody involved. But at that point in time, the Philippine National Police wanted to handle everything, and so the U.S. government had to get out of the way, and we let them finish the case.
What are some common mistakes people make when it comes to negotiations?
Going first. You know, really, it's about patience and finding out what the other side has to say. And if you go first, you're not finding out what the other side has to say. That's the first mistake. People don't realize it's really about gathering information. I want to find out what you want. I want to find out what you're interested in. You might be prepared to give me what I want right away. I need to let you talk in order to find that out. You also really want to have your say. I can make a lot of deals if I just let you have your say. All you want is to be heard. However many deals that I can make just by listening to you, I'll make them. So letting the other side have their say is an enormously powerful thing to do right off the bat. It takes patience, deference. There's great power in deference. The second thing I think people do wrong, besides going first, is being too aggressive. Like, you'll drive deals away by being aggressive. I don't want to drive any deal away that I should have made, so I'm not going to be aggressive. I'm going to be really nice. I'm going to be immovable on my terms. I'm going to know what I want, and in a really nice way, I'm going to let you know. But I'm going to be really nice about it. I'm going to smile at you. I'm going to talk with you. I'm going to want you to be comfortable with me. And the more comfortable you get, the more likely you are to tell me what you really want. And if you tell me, instead of I demand it, then you're probably going to be happier with the deal.
What about in the context of work and asking for a pay rise or...
I love that question.
Negotiating a pay rise at work.
I will tell you how to negotiate a pay raise. And I was once doing some training for a company. And all the salespeople, it was a Zoom conversation at the time during the pandemic. So the CEO and all the salespeople were on the Zoom. And one of them said, how do we negotiate a pay raise? And it was like everybody held their breath because CEO's right there. And they're wondering what I'm going to say. And I'll tell you what I told them. And I'll tell you that the CEO said, I wish everybody that worked for me would say that. So what I said was, ask the boss, how can I be guaranteed to be involved in projects that are critical to our future? Now, as soon as you ask how you can help the boss, not just help him, but on the most important stuff, the boss says, wait a minute, what? You want to make my life better? You want to work on the most important things that mean the most to me? You want to play in a big game? That's exactly the kind of person I want. Now, you get involved in those projects that set you up for a great pay raise because you got involved in really important stuff to whoever's in charge. You want to guarantee your boss's future. And one of two things happen. Either you get a great pay raise after you perform, or you get such great experience that somebody else is going to hire you for the same pay raise. When I told everybody to ask the boss that question, he said, I wish everyone would ask me that.
Wow. And what about in the context of email or WhatsApp or messaging?
Right.
How has that changed negotiation, or should we never negotiate on email or WhatsApp?
Well, use it as a tool. You know, I do text messaging, I do WhatsApp, I do emails, but not exclusively. The first problem that people make in emails especially and their text messages, first think about it as if you were playing chess. If you're going to play chess via email, would you put 7 moves in the same email? No, of course not. You just put one. But most people, they write a long email or they send a long message, they put 3 to 5 to 7 things in it when they should only put one in it. And that's why, first of all, nobody wants to read long messages. And secondly, that stuff's confusing. So if you just send one message at a time, first hint, one message at a time. Secondly, text messages and emails are always going to be read in the tone of voice of the mood of the reader at the moment. If they're tired, they're going to think you're yelling at them. If somebody else just yelled at them, they're going to hear it in a negative tone of voice. Usually at best, the tone of voice that it's heard is cold. You know, you may send somebody a message that's like, yes, and they may read it, yes. Or, you know, there's a great skit by, who are they? I think Jordan and Peele, or, you know, right. Forgive me for, but, you know, they're doing a skit where they're sending text messages back and forth to each other. And one guy sends a text like, hey, I'm happy to meet you, you know, whenever, whatever you want. And the guy on the other end reads it and goes, whatever you want. And so when they show up to meet, one guy is there ready to fight and the other guy's happy to see him because the tone was way off. So if you understand how to really use it effectively, and I'll use a text message to get somebody on the phone, or I'll use an email to get somebody on the phone, but I'll let them know what I want to talk about concisely, mm-hmm. so that when we get on the phone, they don't waste their time. So if you put it all together, you can do really well.
And what about in the context of relationships, negotiating when in a relationship?
Well, somebody a moment ago was telling me a story about their significant other who'd read my book 3 times.
And
she's okay with that.
I've just realized I'm probably being played all the time.
Well, hey, along those same lines, here's one of my favorite stories. There's two good friends of mine that have been read the book a long time ago, Yonda and Mercy. And Mercy one day says to her then fiance, her now husband, she says, I really like talking to you recently. What's going on? And he kind of puts his head down and he says, well, taking this negotiation training based on his book, Never Split the Difference. And the guy who's giving me the training, who was my son, Brandon Voss, Brandon's giving him the training at the time. He says, do this with the people in your life to practice and get better at it. And she went out and bought books for all of her girlfriends, husbands, and boyfriends. Because it's about really listening, mm-hmm. and really collaborating and really having a great long-term relationship. And so if you believe that's what negotiating is about, and almost everybody that's read the book believes in long-term productive relationships, mm-hmm. then you should negotiate with each other. Your significant other deserves to be understood, deserves to be heard out, actually listened to. So I think it's great for personal relationships.
In your book, you talk about tactical empathy.
Right.
Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's applied people smarts. the short answer. And so what's different about tactical empathy versus what most people think of empathy? Most people think empathy is sympathy. That's not the case. Understanding is not agreeing. Then the real problem is most people think, all right, so empathy is putting yourself in the other person's shoes or seeing it from their point of view so you can make a better argument. Well, that's the first step, but you don't make a better argument. What you do is you actually tell people what you think their point of view is. Mm-hmm. Like, I might say, look, I think you're disappointed in the situation because you had higher expectations of me and you had higher expectations of what the opportunities were. And then when you found out there was stuff that was being hidden from you, it just made you really angry. That's just articulating the other person's point of view. It's not saying you agreed or disagreed. You know, a personal relationship, it could be like, it looks like you expected that I would do more here. It looks like you expected that based on understanding your point of view, I would have taken a different approach. Mm-hmm. That's just me saying what your perspective is, which is why I think Sam Harris called it, you know, a form of reasoning. I'm trying to think about where you're coming from. And then I've got to say it out loud to see if I got it right. You know, how do I know that I've got your point of view right? I got to check with you. If I don't check with you, I don't know that I'm right. Or if I'm wrong, I don't give you the chance to help me get it right. And that's where the collaboration comes in. Because if I'm really trying to get your point of view right and I get it wrong, you'll help me, which then means we're collaborating.
Very interesting. Can you share some tips on how to deal or negotiate with someone who seems difficult or unresponsive?
Well, all right, so if they're difficult, they're probably defensive. And most of the people that are difficult, they just don't know any better and they don't know how to protect themselves. So just demonstrating if someone's being difficult with you, they probably feel like they're under a lot of pressure. So what do you say? It sounds like you're under a lot of pressure. Sounds like you've dealt with people like me in the past and they disappointed you. Sounds like you're tired of people not telling you the important points. One real big problem in business globally is people don't know how to deliver bad news. So consequently, it's deception by omission. They don't mean to lie, they're just not telling you the whole truth. That's what disappoints most people in business and in relationships. So, you know, we teach people how to give somebody bad news, how to tell the truth, how to be, in the United States, we would call them a straight shooter, how to be honest, but honest gently. And people really appreciate that. And until you know how to do it, it's a really hard thing to do. But that's one of the things that we tell people. So that's a difficult person. Mm-hmm. They probably don't know how to tell the truth in a way that doesn't cause you to get angry. Now, the non-responsive person, different type of problem. The non-responsive person stops talking to you because talking to you is doing them no good. Now, talking to you is doing them no good for one of two reasons and usually a little bit of both. You're not listening, number one. Why should I talk to you if you're not listening? Number two, and even more embarrassing, they've lost influence on their side and they're afraid to tell you about it. Or they have bad news that they're afraid to talk with you about. So again, talking to you does no good if they've lost power or if they've got bad news. So they'll go completely silent because of that. Now, knowing that, you can address the problem and get them talking again, but you have to actually listen. Otherwise, why should they talk to you?
Very interesting. How does cultural background impact negotiation strategies? Do you, in your past, do you deal with people differently based on where they're from?
Well, no, empathy is about focusing in on how the other side sees it and how they react and how they think. So that, by definition, makes it work everywhere. Now, culture becomes a problem when you think your culture is the way to do business. And then you're not paying attention to the other side. There isn't a human being on earth that doesn't want to be understood. Chinese, Pakistani, South America, Africa. As a matter of fact, Never Split the Difference sells very well in China. Mm. It sells well in India. It sells well in Pakistan. It sells hugely well in the Spanish language. The Spanish version is like the number 10 book in the world for business negotiation. And the only business negotiation book that's better than the Spanish version is the American version. But that's, you know, that says that everybody wants to be understood, no matter where you're from, Pakistan, India, Iraq, Colombia, you want to be understood. Now, culture plays a consideration as an overlay to who you are as a person. But how you interpret that is what matters. Like if I'm here in Dubai, I'll start understanding you and I'll say things gently to see if I can understand where you're coming from. And when I'm actually listening, you'll help me on what I've gotten wrong. Or I'll need to read you in the moment, which again is, if you make it about the other person, yeah, then the culture doesn't matter.
Interesting. What advice do you have for somebody who's quite anxious about negotiation or they avoid it?
Well, you're not doing it right. You didn't learn from me.
I mean, I tried with my bosses, but it didn't go very well.
You got to go with the Black Swan method. You got to read Never Split the Difference. Get that copy from your boyfriend and read that book. Take my master class. The next time I come, you're going to have a bigger studio. You're going to be driving a nicer car, and your boss is going to love you.
As we say, inshallah.
People who are anxious about negotiation, they view it as conflict, and they don't like conflict. Now, 1 in 3 people like it. 2 out of 3 don't. And that's what really causes people to be anxious about it, because they see it as a damaging process to the relationship. They want a good relationship. Conflict is either damages a relationship or it's costly. It's inefficient. Mm-hmm. And you don't want that in your life. But if your approach to it is collaboration, designed to create a better relationship, as soon as you get used to that, then you're not worried about it. There was the first salesperson that my company ever hired was a female. And before it was me, my son, and my daughter-in-law, both of which have started their own companies since. But the young lady that we hired, about 6 months in, she said, you know, when I first started working for you guys, there were a lot of jerks that called us on the phone. And now there aren't that many jerks. Well, the people that called didn't change. She changed in her approach. And what used to be conflict for her or things that she worried about or dreaded, as soon as she learned about applied people smarts, then it became a much more pleasant process. And she didn't worry about it because she wasn't going to get into a fight because she knew how to not fight. Even if somebody was combative, how do you calm them down? How do you get them comfortable talking with you? And almost everybody that learns this, they find their life, they enjoy life more. Mm-hmm. And negotiation is no longer conflict. Negotiation is about a better relationship and longer collaboration. And then it's easier. You're no longer afraid of it.
Do you think it's more difficult for women to negotiate?
Bad negotiation is more difficult for women. Yeah. You know, like the classic example of yelling, being the loudest person in the room, or being demanding. But that's not the kind of negotiation that I teach. As a matter of fact, what we have found, like being really good at it, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. Women pick this style of negotiation up faster than men do. The one of the really cool things about the masterclass, which my masterclass is the most popular class they have on all of masterclass.
Wow.
But better than that is it's really popular with women. It was the first thing that we ever put out. And after it had been out for about a year or two, they got back to me and they said, this is ridiculously popular with women. And I think the reason for that is they don't want to be jerks. by and large, women are nurtured to be collaborative at an earlier age because little boys are taught to fight. You know, little girls, the older women around them are like, well, you may be bigger than he is right now, but when you're 20, you're not going to be. So you need to learn emotional intelligence now. You need to learn to be collaborative now. You need how to avoid combat now. Learn how to avoid combat now, which is really what this negotiation's about. So women are sort of pre-trained more than men, not exclusively, but generally speaking, and they have a tendency to pick it up faster with this approach.
How important is body language when it comes to negotiation?
Body language is contextual. So it can be a great help as long as you realize that everybody's body language is only alike in general terms. But really specifically, you've got to really learn the other person, which is what empathy is about. Mm-hmm. Like, do they cross their arms when they're angry, or do they cross their arms when they're really relaxed and listening? So if you look at somebody's body language, you put it in the context of the conversation and how they react. And so then body language can be very helpful, can be a very encouraging thing. Like, for example, your body language, as we talk, you've got a little bit of a tilt of your head to the side, mm-hmm. which is a universal sign of interest. So between a slight head tilt and then a nod up and down, mm-hmm. both of those are extremely encouraging and signs of genuine curiosity. And when the person you're talking to is genuinely curious, if they haven't learned that, for some reason, universally, when you're really curious and interested, everybody does that. And it tends to be really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm. What are your top three tips if someone's listening now about how they should negotiate?
Look at it as exploration and not as a win-lose proposition. And you'll find it much more comfortable. The biggest problem people have is taking themselves hostage, which means if I talk to them, I can't say no. I got to say yes. Well, if you can tell yourself, look, I can have this conversation and not make an agreement, at least not in this conversation, and nobody ever makes an agreement in the first conversation anyway. Mm-hmm. By and large, no deal is made in less than three conversations. First conversation is always exploratory. So just say, you know, let me just find out where they're coming from. You know, I'm kind of curious. If you can do that, you'll actually be smarter and it'll be much more pleasant for you.
Chris Voss, it's been such an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the Maz Hakian podcast. Where can we follow your journey? And of course, I know your incredible books because my partner's obsessed with them. but if I could hear a little bit more about your book and your masterclass and where we can follow you.
Well, the website is the goldmine. Everything that we've got. BlackSwanLTD.com, BlackSwanLTD.com. Now, you can subscribe to the newsletter. It's free. It's concise. We've got a lot of free stuff. We've got a lot of really advanced training. Whatever you need is there. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to follow me on Instagram, it's at the FBI Negotiator. But I got to warn you, besides tips on negotiation, mm-hmm. I saw on some post yesterday on CNN that said eating French fries contributed to depression.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I posted that. That depressed me.
Yeah, I was pretty
depressed. Talk about depressed. I was depressed when I saw that.
Yeah, me too.
And I put in, now this is depressing. And then I added in, you know, like if they say this about bourbon, I'm really going to be in trouble.
Yeah. I was... I thought, what? Fries makes me happy. So does coffee and pizza, all the good things that they think causes depression. So, yeah, I'll follow you for your fries content. Thank you so much. Thanks, Chris.
It was my pleasure.